Mark Stahl will read. You will listen. Welcome now, Mark Stahl.
Good evening. No individual, whether willfully or not, can ever fully divulge in public all that he is. This fundamental presupposition is an instrumental belief in our shared public life. We take for granted that all individuals are inherently more complex than what the mere surface phenomenon of public presentation can ever communicate. We assume that the majority of our public dealings with others will tell as much about their true, total personalities as the facades of houses tell about the contents of those homes. Without question, we accept the fundamental discrepancy between appearance and overall reality. As Harvard has said, appearances are deceiving, and this one maxim is a standing rule. Men are not what they seem. When the individual is in public, he will only give a very narrow range of information about himself. This statement strikes us as true. It seems consistent with the belief that the individual has definite motives for acting as he does. If he divulges too much about himself, it could mean risking full disclosure of his motives. As a consequence of the beliefs that I've sketched out here, the public presentation of self soon acquires a hardened, institutionalized image. This image reflects the generalized, stereotypical expectations that are brought to any public event, but which bear most strongly on the public presentation of personality. It is obvious from this, from what has just been said, that public speaking is implicated here. We all know that it takes more time and effort to discern the subtleties and the far-reaching implications of a particular speaker's argument than it does to judge him and the merit of his presentation on the basis of the image that he projects. Is the speaker's manner one of confidence and integrity? Does he appear to be sincere and straightforward? His projected self-assurance reassures his audience that he has the complete command of the facts. His deportment and demeanor, his bearing and manner, are taken to serve as indicators of his basic decency, fairness, and honesty. Never mind the faults or virtues of his argument, for any conclusions reached by his listeners will be based on stock images, on images that issue from a permanent and habitual state of mind. Who then is the public speaker? What is he if he is not the image that he projects? Well, he is a lonely worker. He is an isolated craftsman who is quietly working the last days of a dying trade. He is a quaint curiosity, a figure out of step. He is an oddity of his time. He is, in fact, a loose thread from an antique garment, a remnant from a bolt of fabric that has long been out of fashion. In short, he is quite simply an anachronism. The speaker belongs to a great class of occasional workers. And as is the case with so many infrequent workers, he finds that his services are called upon with increasing rarity. More specifically, the speaker is a member of an ever-dwindling class of artisans. This class is preoccupied with the maintenance of its own traditions, a preoccupation, we might add, that is not out of character for any cottage industry. The effect of custom is to preserve in the world with the force of law what may have only entered the world as a result of caprice. Indeed, it is custom that encourages the speaker to view the occasion of his address as that conspicuous forum for the victorious assertion of personality. However, the speaker remains mindful that, in the vast sea of contemporary communications, he is but a tiny sinking island. Nonetheless, he has secured this opportunity to impose his personality on the audience, to impress his personality on the situation. Defiantly, he has climbed up to this platform tonight to claim it again as the throne of the public personality. The speaker and his audience have a conspiratorial air about them. They conspire to preserve a thoroughly outmoded practice, an obsolete technology. Meeting as a staff of so many nervous preservationists, they anxiously huddle together and crouch over a corpse to inject the last few precious drops of embalming fluid. A circumstantial army of caretakers, they look after the continually shrinking grounds of a once palatial estate, an estate encroached on by the march of time. Despite what I have said about the speaker and his project, or perhaps because of it, the image of the public speaker still looms large in our public life today. After all, who can deny the sheer persuasive power of the authoritative speaker making bold, sure-footed strides through the dark forest of conflicting facts and opinions to the sunny clearing of his argument's conclusion? The image is perennial. The image itself has acquired a meaning that is wholly independent from any particular public speaking performance. We are now disposed to recall the prevalent image of the public speaker, the image of the dynamic, persuasive leader, the fiery orator stationed at the pulpit, the extraordinary individual who brightly shines through that dense fog of common faces. Today, however, this image of the speaker, the image that the popular imagination enlists, has been supplanted by the reality of today's public speakers. For these speakers serve as the official spokesmen, the delegated apologists for monolithic bureaucratic organizations. As bureaucracies grow larger and become more entrenched, they divert more time and energy to the maintenance of the separation of the image that they present to their publics from the often inconsistent and disorderly behind-the-scenes work that constitutes their everyday working reality. By contrast, this speaker hopes and endeavors to reflect on his public image and the work that preceded it. While he can't pretend to entirely break down this separation of the management of his image from his behind-the-scenes work, he will, at the very least, attempt to highlight this separation in his presentation here tonight. The speaker is mindful that not only is his presentation a management of information, but that the management of his public image is of itself a very specific and special kind of information. I have spoken of the need of bureaucracies to maintain a consistent public image, an image that is distinct from their day-to-day internal workings. Permit me an example of this idea, which may be closer to our own personal experience. No one in this room is a stranger to that experience of having their work go unappreciated. Everyone has had their work dismissed by others who have had no knowledge of the tremendous effort and the long, hard hours that have gone into it. Often this is a result of the fact that a particular product or service is a poorly designed advertisement for all the work, skill, knowledge, and expertise that stand behind it. We fall victim to an unintentional camouflaging of our labor when we don't give due consideration to the importance of creating, maintaining, and projecting a consistent, clear, and always easily comprehensible image of our labor. To do this is to give expression to the need in us all to have our work recognized and rewarded by others. In most occupations, the worker must dramatize the image of his labor to convince others of the concentrated effort in his work. The need to project a consistent image of one's labor and to exaggerate this image for effect manifests the deep-seated notion of labor providing its own rewards. I've selected the words of two great minds to drive home this last point. First, Tolstoy has said, "The happiness of men consists in labor, and labor is in life." And second, the words of Henry Ford, "Work does more than get us our living, it gets us our life." When a worker exaggerates the image of his working process, he is concealing his true involvement in his activity just as much as when the loafer conceals his idleness with a look of being deeply lost in thought. In contrast to this, this speaker hopes to conceal the intensity of his labors. He chooses to play down the demanding nature of the project before him rather than exaggerating it. In preparing to read this text tonight, he has anticipated a strenuous and conscientious endeavor. The text has already imposed its harsh demands in all phases of its production. Now it gives the speaker toil in its moment of public broadcast. The speaker is produced by the occasion of the publication of the text, its live performance. Yet he cannot forget that the construction of the text itself was a performance, but a performance in which he functioned both as audience and performer. It was a performance of uncharted duration. It was a labor that was discontinuous, fragmented, and incomplete. Indeed, this text is a product of collaging. It is a combination of fragments. It is a product of binding together piles of disparate sentences and random phrases. It is a product of erasure and superimposition, of deletions, substitutions, and rearrangement. This text is a fantastic and silly patchwork, a pastiche. It is an intricately woven carpet of so many delicately colored threads that I now so clumsily trod upon. It is a twisting, sinister path strangled with dry, crackling underbrush, hazard with thorny bushes and creeping vines. Is it all but the product of a bewildered and agitated mind? All the hardships that were endured in the production of this text will remain forever inaccessible to anyone but the producer himself. So too will all the exhilarating moments of chance combinations and happy coincidences that occurred in the production of this text be known to no one but the producer. The speaker must, however, put aside his intimate working knowledge of the text. He strives to appear at home, secure in the routine competence that a workaday familiarity with his material brings. Were it otherwise, undue attention might be focused on the form of his delivery, detracting from the substance of his remarks. The speaker struggles to cover up the persistent strain of his present undertaking. His purpose is to disentangle himself from that thorny dilemma of expression versus action, of, in other words, the labor of projecting an image of his personality versus the work of reading the text that rests before his eyes tonight. Let me close, then, not with a directive, not with a command, not with a plea for action, but with a question. Has not this speaker's professed desire to conceal the toll of his labors made his actions just as insidious as those of the average worker who, instead of concealing his labors, dramatizes them? Thank you for your attention.